These are strange fucking times. The ducks think we're less than human. We can't own, we can't vote, and yet somehow we're responsible for the economic woes of their entire nation. They hate us because they fear us, and that fear is where we get our fucking edge. You get me? The Hop Way keeps that fear alive. They stay the fuck out of Chinatown, and we all continue to earn.
Yes.
Welcome back to the MTR Network. This is Ro, and today I am here with a special interview with actor Perry Jung, and we're talking about his role on Cinemax's Warrior. If you're not familiar with Warrior, it's a pretty action-packed crime drama based off of a treatment by the famous martial artist Bruce Lee, and executive produced by Bruce Lee's daughter Shannon Lee, in conjunction with some other names you might recognize, Justin Lin. And it is set in San Francisco's Chinatown in the late 19th century. It is a seriously brutally amazing spaghetti western style story built around the Tung Wars and everything that was happening in Chinatown and in San Francisco and in the United States around the 19th century or so. It's a costume drama, it's a historical, it's a spaghetti western, it's like nothing else that you've ever seen on TV. And as far as I'm concerned, with respect to Asian American and Asian representative on TV, it is an absolutely worthy inheritor of an audience from Into the Badlands. And I got the opportunity to interview one of my favorite actors who, I mean, he does better than anybody else. Depending on how much TV you watch, you may recognize Perry Jung from The Nick, or you may recognize his face from John Wick, but he plays one of the heads of the Tong. He's a crime boss, and he does it like nobody else does. Between the story and the martial arts and all the other elements, Warrior is definitely one that you guys should be watching. It is 10 episodes for season 1, and season 2, which premieres tonight, October 2nd at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time, will also be another 10-episode season. It looks at some issues that are extremely relevant and timely from an angle and a perspective that is very valuable and will resonate with you. And in between the monologues that Perry Jung does like no other, there's a significant amount of ass-kicking that always ups the game and keeps things interesting. So without further ado, here's my interview with Perry. Hope you enjoy.
So I watched the first season of Warrior, and when you came on the screen, I screamed, "It's Rufin! It's Rufin!" like an idiot, because clearly I'm special. Because I watched you on The Nick, and you were one of the most dynamic characters that kind of carried the show forward. And I was just, for me anyway, I'm biased, but I'm right, so everyone has to agree with me. But so I was just kind of wondering, because I understand that you had taken a break, and you were doing theater and you were building the most amazing flutes, which I watch you do on YouTube quite frequently. And so how did you come back to being on like film and television?
Wow, Rhonda, that's a really great question. So I was a dancer first, mm-hmm. in New York City. And at the time I got into my first theater production, and a lot of people around me were like, you know, you should try to do film or TV. And, you know, I wasn't really trained as an actor, but I sort of became a natural on stage. So I found my way into some auditions and start, you know, this was around 1993. And then what I saw was not appealing for an actor. Someone as an Asian American, a Chinese American, the roles that we were up for was like waiters or gang leaders and things like that in Chinatown, which I still do, but much better. but, you know, there was nothing else. And so I thought, wow, I don't want to show up and do these one-line things that, you know, basically are stereotypical roles for Asian Americans, especially for men. So I took a break. And luckily for me, in the theater community I was in with La Mama under the late, great Ellen Stewart, I was able to do theater that didn't depend on race, that who the character was. So the experimental theater things was really about just the universality of the human body and what we can do and say, and, you know, things we can do on stage to bring our mind into another sort of consciousness about culture or reality or human existence. These are the things that interested me. And TV seemed to be like a single note that that caged the human spirit for Chinese Americans, especially, or Asian Americans, or other people of color and women. So I thought, this is not the arena for me. And, you know, I took a break. I had children. I luckily found this incredible career crafting Japanese shakuhachi flutes. And then about the time that my children became, you know, like reached the age of 8 or 9, and they were able to sort of be on their own and read on their own and didn't need my constant attention, I started to get a little bored. You know, it was sort of like the shakuhachi is a meditation flute. So my work was really meditative every day, and it was great for me just to sit, you know, be the stay-at-home dad, support my partner. But about that time, I got really bored, and the stage, and you know, was itching. It was calling me, but I couldn't really sacrifice my day job for theater because it didn't, you know, theater, we do it for the love. It doesn't really pay.
So
I thought, you know, if I'm going to explore this and leave, you know, like sort of income, I need to go dive into the world of film or TV, because that's where an actor can actually live. Those lucky few that get jobs on TV and film. And about that time, you know, Justin Lin came about and had this amazing movie, The Fast, or he's the director of Fast and Furious now, but Better Luck Tomorrow. Changed a lot of culture, Asian American culture. And you know, Justin Lin went on to direct The Fast and Furious and Star Trek films and became a franchise on his own. So he started making waves. And then, you know, my friend Daniel Dae Kim landed a role in Lost. And it was like, whoa. We are now people on the screen that are multidimensional. There's an avenue for someone like me. So I started auditioning for film and TV and got these little, did some free things like everyone should do, you know, just to learn the ropes and the jargon. And then I saw this ad for, you know, the Nick. Steven Soderbergh was looking for a character, the proprietor of an opium den in Chinatown. And I went, what the heck? I'm just going to try, you know. They sent me the sides. I auditioned, before I auditioned, I told a friend of mine, Cole Suddeth, who's an actor. I said, Cole, hey, I'm doing this this audition, a self-tape, they call it. And you know, my friend's a TV actor. He's like laughing. Goes, oh, you're going to do a self-tape audition, you know? And he knows that I'm a theater actor. And he goes, you know, let me come by and just hang out with you, you know? So Cole comes by and he goes, oh, here are the sides, and here's, I see you set your camera up this way. Let's read it. And of course, I do it like a theater actor, you know, booming across the room. And Cole just kind of like, whoa, dude, this is not the stage. This is film, a television. You kind of speak to the camera. It's very intimate. It's, you know, it's a whole different thing. So that was like this aha moment, you know, for an actor. It's like, aha, that's how they do it. You know, so he put the camera right in front of my face. He sat right in front of me and he said, talk to me. And that changed everything. So I was very lucky to have a friend in the business sort of tutor me through and guide me through my first audition. And then I got a call back. I mean, it was amazing. You know, the casting director called me, the office emailed me and said, you know, we want to see you in a callback. Can you get here tomorrow? And I was like, whoa, you know, by the time they had sent me the callback, I went on vacation to Maine from New York City. Oh. So that's an 8-hour drive. And I was like, holy shit. Oops, sorry, can I say, you bleep me out.
You are fine.
okay, so I try not to drop the F-bomb, but.
No. I have a potty mouth. You are really fine. Feel free to be you.
Okay, so when I got that email that said, you know, like, Steven Soderbergh wants to see your callback, and it was like, holy shit, I'm in Maine. And I said to my partner, and she was like, you know, Maura said, well, this is the biggest thing you would have ever done, because you're, you know, you've never even done a callback before. You know, if you're a working actor, you get a callback. It's like everything else. You're probably not going to get the job. There's 20 other callbacks. So Maura said, hey, if you get this, if you don't do this, you will never know. And I went, you're right. So I told my friend Cole, I said, hey, they want to see a callback. And he said, holy shit, get your ass over here. You know, by that time we had subletted our apartment for the month. And Cole said, you're going to spend the night with me. I'm going to tutor you in the morning. Then you go do the audition. And so I, you know, drove in 8 hours, spent the night with Cole, woke up in the morning. He gave me a few more tips. Don't try to act, just listen and respond. I was like, okay. That's the most difficult thing to do, actually, when the camera's on. Just listen and respond. It's the most difficult. You want to act, you know, which is like, don't act, you know. Anyway, so I did the audition. I went, okay, you know, they just went, thanks for coming. I drove back to Maine, and I got pulled over on the way back by state trooper. And I went, holy shit, now I'm going to have to. I rented a car for, you know, $80. Now I'm going to get a $200 speeding ticket. I missed, you know, 2 days with my family on this lake. And, you know, this is going to be an expensive, like, lesson. And so I got back, you know, returned the car. I said, you know, let's just wait. Let's see what happens. And then Maura says, well, you tried. You know, you learned something. And I was like, yeah, that's right. About 2 days later, I get a call. And the casting director says, Steven Soderbergh wants you. And I said, holy shit!
I'd have passed out. I'd have passed all the way out. I'd have just passed out. Someone had to revive me.
Maura came in. It's like, what? And then she's grabbing me and I'm jumping. And that's the Steven Soderbergh wants me. And she starts to scream, you know? And we're just like, oh my God, this is the moment. And she just like stood back and looked at me. She goes, this is the moment. This is that moment people talk about. When did it happen, you know? And it was like, wow. And I was just like walking on clouds for a couple of days. I told my friend Cole. And Cole was like, holy shit. He screamed in the phone. He goes, that never happens, dude. That never happens. I didn't have an agent. I didn't have, I wasn't a member of the union. I didn't have any on-camera acting experience. I actually, when they asked me for my reel, I went, well, you know, ask Cole. I said, what do? I don't have a reel. Cole asked his manager. His manager said, well, send them any reviews you have of your theater shows. Just say, because you're just new to all this. You know, they're open to that kind of stuff. And they are. And let me tell you, I read a review with the casting director, Carmen Cuba. And Carmen Cuba says, I like to discover people who haven't been discovered, who haven't done anything, who just got in because they're fresh. And that's, I couldn't be any fresher, you know? So I thank Carmen Cuba with it. You know, she's, I mean, her casting department is amazing. They took a chance on me. And I got on set and I was shitting bricks that first day because I knew nothing. I knew nothing about what to do on television, you know, on the set. I had, you know, 20 years of theater experience, but you know, some of that is useful. Some of that is useful when they say action and how do you connect with your actor? And then you put your tools of acting to work. But, you know, behavior on the set and understanding the hierarchy and all that stuff. And I knew nothing, you know, so, but yeah, I remember that being like one of the scariest days of my life.
You came back to acting and Steven Soderbergh said, come on over here. I'd have passed out, but I'm not gonna lie. I have this thing for shows that kind of try to reconnect history to the people who were actually there who are very rarely seen. And The Nick was one of the first times when you got to look at parts of that world. You know, we get worlds with doctors who were in hospitals and bedlam. And every once in a while, you may go around to a couple of the houses that are around where they work, but you don't ever really get the city. And if you do, it's all white. I mean, because
So true.
I mean, I'm not trying to be like controversial or anything. It's like, but when you're centering your story around a person and the person who you're centering that story around is white, writers, camera people, even production locations and like the way they design how things look, they're centering it around the person or people who are at the middle. And it's very easy for the viewer to think, oh, okay, so we didn't live there. They didn't live there. Everybody there was white. So, or when they do, and you get a character who is like, you know, the owner of a opium den, they're always very caricature drawn, or they're very one dimensional, or they only pop up when you need the twirling villain. And on The Nick, you were real. You were a three real dimensional person who I don't ever want to owe money to ever.
But I'm a loyal friend, let me tell you. You know,
to Thackeray. Oh, you got your people.
I look out for Thackeray. He's my friend.
Yes. But you also brought a new sense of what loyalty meant on screen.
Thank you so much for saying that. Because, you know, when I saw the role, the first thing I saw was the trappings of the tropes of stereotype in Hollywood, like you mentioned. You know, we see our stories. People of color see their stories told through a white lens. And It was there as it is some ways in Warrior, but it's our way in right now in Hollywood. It's our step at the door. And when we see an opportunity, we can sort of take advantage of that. I mean, some people see it as a, you know, like yet another stereotype I have to play, but I see it as an opportunity. So it was written with a thick accent, Chinese accent. So I did that accent for the audition. But, you know, when I showed up on set and we just started blogging and rehearsing with Steven, and you know, I'm saying, oh, Steven, what if I tried it like this? And, you know, and he goes, oh, that's a good idea. Let's do that. Let's do, okay, action. And then I say my first line, how many bowls? And Steven goes, oh, wait, cut. Wait, look, drop the accent. Let's do it as Perry. And it was like, whoa, you know, the angels sang. I mean, the clouds parted. It was like, this is the dream moment where a director says, drop the accent, do it as yourself. And I was like, wow. I mean, I was, that was like going through my body with a camera was on me and all the production assistants and lighting people and the mic people were all like ready for the next shot. I'm just going, now, how do I translate that? This is the most incredible moment of my life. You know, like the actors dream about. Drop the accent, especially Asian Americans, when we're always told to do an accent. So even in Warrior, but I love the way that they play with the idea of doing an accent.
Yeah.
So when Steven said, do it as Perry, because, you know, in 1900 in Chinatown, you could have been born there. And I was like, that's absolutely true. I could have been born in Chinatown at that time. So yes, when I see an opportunity, I want to take advantage of it to show millions of people that a Chinese person can be a real person, real people that Hollywood don't normally want to show you, because actually a lot of these writers don't have any friends that are Asian Americans. You know, my friend Tai Ma, who plays a father in Mulan and the father in The Farewell, recently said, you know, I felt sorry for those writers, you know, because every once in a while in those police procedures, they would be like, let's do our Chinatown scene. And then all the writers would have to go look up all those Chinese, you know, sitcoms that had Chinatown scenes because they had no Asian American friends. And so, they, you know, nowadays, because of, you know, the global community and social media and, you know, way more films and content based on Asian Americans in America, we have a better idea that we have an idea that they're like anybody else. Really, yeah. You know, like The Farewell. I mean, it's amazing. You know, even The Farewell that's in another language, we see her as it's an American story.
She's a New York girl. Yeah.
Right.
But the thing that I really like about what drew me to Warrior is Warrior was happening right as Into the Badlands was ending. And I was really bummed out because Into the Badlands was the first time that I got to see somebody take genre and apply a lot of the filmmaking techniques that you don't see in America, especially for fight scenes and the way that it centered women and the way that it centered Asian characters, whether they were from the diaspora or if they were actually from the mainland in Japan or China. And so I had a slight Jones for a show. And my mom was like, well, do you have Cinemax? I'm like, yeah. She's like, well, they're making that Bruce Lee show. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. She's like, whoa. you know, the show that she's like, the show Kung Fu was supposed to be, because that's how my mother describes anything. Right. Because when I was younger, one of the unifying aspects for television in our house were martial arts movies. Mm-hmm. My father was completely addicted to, it came on Saturdays, they called it Chinese theater, and you would get the old style from China or other countries, and you would get those. And then you started getting Bruce Lee movies. And then my mom would come in and sit down. And I was like, why won't you watch the other ones, but you watch this one? She's like, oh, because he's funny. I was like, what? She's like, he's funny. His movies are funny. And he's always the bad guy who's not the bad guy. I like that. I like those movies. So that was my introduction to martial arts. That was my introduction to Bruce Lee. And then we would watch, my oldest brother did martial arts. So he was obsessed with Bruce Lee. He had a gi, everything. When he would do any of his talks on TV about his ideology or his philosophy, we would watch them, the old black and white footage, which wasn't old then. And then we saw Kung Fu and my mom was like, that's a white boy.
I love your mom already.
I mean, I aspire only to be so good. But my level set for what I was supposed to be looking for when I was looking at Asian people on screen, my mom's best friend is Filipino. And she would come in when like they would do the episode, you'd see someone, she's like, we don't talk like that. And she'd just walk out of the room. So there was this little bit of a cognitive dissonance when I was younger, because as a Black person, I was lucky enough to have friends from all different ethnicities and cultures. According to my mom, for like 2 years, I didn't eat American food and I only spoke Tagalog because that's what my babysitter was. Wow. So I couldn't speak a word now to save my life. But apparently young me was international. So when I heard about Warrior, and I looked up the premise and I saw that his daughter was actually involved. So this wasn't somebody else who was stealing one of his, you know, mm-hmm. concepts or pitches that they found sitting around somewhere. And then I realized they were going to actually set it in San Francisco in the Chinatown there. I was like, okay, I have to see this because I love period pieces. I like the ones that aren't set in the Regency era where it's more easy to pretend everybody was non-white. There were no non-white people that needed to be centered. And then I'm not gonna lie, I heard you were on the show and I was like, well, at least now I know we're gonna get a hell of a monologue because you have a way with a speech. I swear to God, the first time you came on the screen and they zoom in on your face and you start talking, I was like, see, he's gonna kill everybody.
Oh, this is too good. I mean, it's really funny, you know, because the stuff they gave me on the Nick and in War are like monologues. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have a lot of like dialogue, scene dialogue with a lot of other people. A lot of my things, even when you see sides auditions, they say character does a speech. I mean, a lot of my stuff are speeches, you know, I'm like, wow, they like writing speeches for me, you know? So,
yeah. Have you seen yourself give a speech, sir?
Well, I mean, it's you know, it's, I have so much gratitude for the writers. I mean, Jonathan Tropper and Shannon Lee. I mean, this had to be done, but you know, it took 40 years. It took 40 years from when Bruce Lee wrote this, and by the time people were, or maybe Shannon felt comfortable to have the right producers. I mean, to find Justin and Jonathan in this, you know, and to be on the same project with these people who actually really have their finger on the button of culture and what's important, you know, cutting across, just getting to true humanity. I mean, Jonathan Tropper's work on Banshee is amazing because it's about humanity. You know, it's very Shakespearean. We get into the heart of what it means to be human. And Jonathan, you know, is the showrunner. He writes the material. He works in the room with the other writers, and we have amazing writers from Badlands, if you didn't know that, Evan Endicott and Josh Stoddard from Badlands. I mean, amazing writers and so great, truly great human beings also, you know, all the writers, Kenneth Lynn, you know, and Shannon, you know, of course, when I first heard about the production, I read it on Deadline, maybe around 2017, that Bruce Lee's real script is going to be produced by his daughter with Justin Lin. I went, oh my God, I have to get into this show, you know. And I sent that article to my manager and said, Davian Littlefield, you have to, you know, find out when they're auditioning for this. And Davian said, yes, we'll keep an eye out. And then 2018, they had auditions, and I went, you know. I had to get on the show. But you know, it's like everything else. You want it so badly, you're not going to get it. So I didn't want to jinx myself either. But it was one of those things where you read the model, you read the sides. I read the sides, you know, the script for Father June, my character, and it was another monologue. And I went, oh, okay. Like that's the hardest thing to do in an audition. You know, when you have dialogue, you feed off the reader, and you get to show yourself in a natural flow that you can listen and respond. But when you have a monologue, you just have this camera on your face and everyone looking at you to see what you're going to do with it. And so I had this monologue, and I'm reading the monologue. I went, this monologue is about justice. It's about social justice. It's about the right, equal rights. This is Martin Luther King. And this is Malcolm X talking right here. It was right in that monologue, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was my the seed, you know? It was like Father June is a social warrior. You know, he's a Tong, but he's not in it for the money. His speech was like, you know, these ducks are killing us. We have to defend ourselves. And this is why I run the most notorious Tong in Chinatown, to defend our people against the, you know, violence of the ducks. And you're like, wow, I want to be that guy. You know, back in 1870s, you know, like, I want to be the guy building up an army to prevent lynchings. You know, we had lynchings and things like that. A show like Warrior is brave enough to dramatize. You know, we had people coming in and burning down Chinatown. You don't see that on everyday TV. So, and you know, when, and you know, with Shannon Lin, when she's Shannon Lee, when she stepped on the set, we were like, I am not screwing this up. You know?
Yeah, no.
Nobody here is messing this up. This is Bruce Lee. I mean, you're talking about the extras, the hair and makeup people, the lighting people. Everybody's a fan of Bruce Lee. Nobody is messing this up. You know, when I went on my days off, I went to watch them shoot. And one day we were watching the big fight scene on episode season one, when the whole Chinatown clashes with the gangs along Z. And it was just spectacular. I mean, all kudos to Brett Chang of Hits International, the fight coordinator, stunt team trainer. He's done some fabulous work, as good as, you know, the best Hong Kong kind of, you know, cinema in this genre. And so I'm watching this stuff and I'm just like, this is really amazing. And then I had this makeup people come up next to me and go, this is really amazing. You know, I was like, I know. And then the set photographer, David Burrows, comes up to me and he goes, this is really amazing. I said, I know. You know, it's like, you just, it's infectious. You know, the energy, the dedication, the focus of these people. I mean, I saw one of the stunt people get hurt and he's sitting by the side, you know, like rubbing his wrist. And they're like, you want to take a break or you want to, like, we can replace you. He's like, no, I'm ready to go. You know, it's such, I mean, this show is about, like, fans, you know. It's about Bruce Lee fans. The writers and creators are fans of Bruce Lee. I mean, Bruce Lee's daughter. So this is all coming from the heart. And, you know, we see that it's also entertainment. It's also pure high adrenaline dramatic entertainment. But there's but the producers sneak in the lessons the society has to learn. So, you know, in a great way, it's like, ah, there's the history that you mentioned. It's real history.
Yeah.
In 1882, Chinese Americans were not allowed into the country. It was the first law to discriminate solely based upon race. And it's the reason Chinatown didn't have any women and it was all men. You know, the powers to be said, you can't bring your women because you can't start families here. We only want your labor. And then you either die here or you go home. So it was pretty much, you know, stated to us, we don't want you here. You can't bring your women. Of course, they found ways to get women in, which the story is true to. And actually, the really interesting part is a lot of them, you know, a lot of the Chinese men married African-American women and Irish women, you know, who were sort of the same class because they didn't have access to the upper class women who were basically the white women. But there's so much in true history in Warrior that it makes someone like me who's, you know, an American, a Chinese American, has never seen my history portrayed properly in mainstream television. It's so gratifying to be a part of the show.
Yeah, well, as a Black person watching, I thought it was great because the parallels between, like, the way people are portrayed, but also the absences in history were really kind of compelling to me. Now, obviously, Warrior Season 2 is coming into a post-Watchmen world. And I actually hope that makes people go back who may not have watched season one or who missed stuff in season one and pick up on the show. Because I feel like shows like Warrior do a very good job of reconnecting history to the people who've been cut out of it. Like, there's maybe there was a paragraph about Chinatown and the Chinese people, and it's always related to the railroad, and then it skips right to the war, then it skips right to the earthquake, then it skips right to laundry. And I was like, no, there has to be something missing, but you also can't find it when you go looking for it. So,
I'm sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
I was going
to
say, so if you're fascinated by these kinds of things and you like spaghetti westerns, which I do, a show like Warrior is a perfect way to kind of bring you into a city that you know if you live in America, and then show you all the different layers of how that city came to be and why maybe we should be taking a little bit better care of the heritage of that city now.
Oh, no, that's great. That's so great. I mean, there's so much history. Obviously, we can only learn from history, hopefully. What I wanted to address earlier was that our stories are not told. We jump, you know, only to satisfy a certain storytelling. Mm-hmm. But like we people of color are silenced in this country. And until we have our own voice, until we have access to our own storytelling, you know, media, which is more and more these days, and especially in the last 20 years, it's only then that our voices will be heard and will be seen beyond, you know, these stereotypes. And yes, we are silenced every day in the news when you hear about things that are happening to the Asian American community and nobody reports on it, then we don't know about that. Like recently, because of, you know, the COVID, you know, situation, yeah, where our number 45 is calling it China virus on purpose, and we can say that there's a lot of anti-Asian violence based on his using the word, you know, referring to it as China virus. Recently, there was an 89-year-old Chinese grandmother in Brooklyn who was set on fire, and the police didn't actually report on it. Nobody reported it. It's like, somebody was set on fire in Brooklyn. Why isn't anybody reporting it? If it was a white woman set on fire, you know, it'd be all over the news. Right. So there was an 89-year-old grandmother, didn't speak any English. She was Chinese. But so the Chinese reporter for CBS, I think it was, went to her and you know, I got a report on this. So because of her, it became a story. And then the community rallied and said, look, the police, you got to call this a hate crime so we can escalate this. They wouldn't call it a hate crime. And somebody in the police department, you know, said under wraps that if we call it a hate crime, it's going to sort of get big and blow up, that they can't really deal with it blowing up. It's like, why can't they deal with a Chinese American grandmother, you know, violence perpetrated upon her? Why can't we see it as a hate crime? Why can't we see things happening to Asians as real things? So if things aren't reported about our community, we're silenced. We don't get to tell our stories. Yeah. People don't get to hear who we are and see us in a bigger light. So, and thus that perpetuates violence against us, and people can talk to us as if we don't understand English and things like that.
Well, that's the point that I was going into. It's like, you guys are Asians and Black people, but to a different aspect. Asian Americans are frozen amber at what's the first initial impression, and that's the impression that's continuously pumped out now. It's like the context that you gave for why there started being what white people describe as trafficking in women was to try to get Asian women here because men weren't allowed to bring their wives and their daughters because they couldn't start families here. That's not a context that ever gets put in. Or like when you watch this show and you see all the different kinds of ways that people are interacting with people and the stark shock that they show on white faces when an Asian person looks at them and says, I understand you. That hasn't changed.
Like, it happens every day still today. You know, there was a comic strip a friend of mine sent me, Celia Au, who's an actress, you know, like a white woman says to an Asian woman, hey, your English is great. And that white Asian woman says, hey, yours is great too. And the white woman says, that's because I was born here. And then the Asian woman goes, oh, I was born here also.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like this idea that somehow there's a portal that you can go back through to the entire Asian continent and then the next day come back through the portal here. And I really feel a lot of it has to do with episodic television. How Chinatowns are portrayed. People don't know the history of Chinatowns. They don't know how old they are. They don't even know why they exist. And a lot of Black people are trifling. And I'll say it. I don't care. We complain a lot about how Black history gets skewed or gets buried or gets perverted, but we don't make any effort to go learn the history of other people who came to this country and were then almost immediately marginalized. I know about the Exclusion Act because my godmother taught me about it. It clearly wasn't in school. Mm-hmm. And it's the same impact. Like, I was watching this show with one of my really good friends, and he was like, how did they think of this setting? This is really fascinating. They managed to interweave and connect all these problems that feel really relevant now. It's fascinating. Did they just take it from Black history? And I looked at him and said, you do know Chinese people been here since the 19th century, right? Like, they came out, they really? He's like, no, but I mean, like, the whole San Francisco. I was like, where do you think Chinatowns came from? I mean, we didn't build them. We're not Chinese. I was like, what? And there was no connection in his head that the same way that post-slavery Black people were funneled into neighborhoods or into certain industries, Asian people were funneled the same way that indigenous people were forced onto reservations and only, you know, there's always this model image. And I swear to God, white people love a model minority.
Oh, don't say that. Oh. I mean, what you're saying is so true. It's so true about, like, we just don't know, like, how inept our own education is. And I'm not saying that people are stupid. It's okay. But it's
a choice. I mean,
it's ignorance.
We choose to stay ignorant. We don't go looking.
Absolutely, you know, but it's a lot of work, right? Isn't it a lot of work to know about all of this? You know, so it's like, unless, I mean, our education system is curated, right? By, like, through the white supremacist lens of, like, this is what we want you to know about history. And this is what, of course, you know, now that we have revisionist history, we can learn that there's a lot more to what we were told. And I think the great thing about Warrior and the geniuses of it is, like, it tells you exactly what history is in a very, and served in a really nice, tasty dish. So you want more, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
I started going and looking stuff up. Like, your first monologue talking about, first I had to get around the ethnic slurs and the the nicknames. We'll call them nicknames.
Yeah.
Okay. For people. But it took a minute because they're not terms I'm familiar with, because, like, my mom considered a lot of words to be a pejorative, and I like my life, so I didn't say them. So I also wasn't seeking out other words to learn what they meant. So the first time that someone spoke, I was like, why are they calling y'all onions? What is this duck? What in the hell? So I went and I started Googling, and I was like, oh my God. Oh God. This is all, oh God. And so then I went back and watched it. And just as soon as you feel like you've gotten stuck in a stereotype, they flip it. They're using all of the tropes from Westerns that people are very used to, and even down to kind of some of the, like, the subtle musical cues.
Mm-hmm.
And they, like, when they were showing Father Jun and his son and the relationship between the two, how often do you get to see a relationship between a father and a son where they're both powerful in their own right, but dad is still dad, without it kind of descending into some assumed cultural behavior in that house?
I love what Jonathan did with my character and young June, because it really is father and son. Mm-hmm. Okay, beyond anything else, it's a very Shakespearean father and son passing power. You know, is the son ready for this and all this? And it's done in the context of the Tongs, you know. And aside from that, the deep level for me as a Chinese American, I'm going back to this, is I've never seen that on TV. I've never seen a Chinese father and son talking about real issues on TV. I mean, I think recently the only one was ABC's Fresh Off the Boat by Eddie Huang. And Eddie was mad at that show because they sort of, you know, made fun, like they made comedy out of his tragedy, you know? But you've never really see a father and son, especially Chinese American. That's why it meant so much to me. It was like, wow, all those other Chinese Americans who feel disenfranchised by the media can really say, hey, that finally we have a real father and son on TV here. I mean, it's not mainstream TV, but they can see it.
Yeah, but it's also the kind of father you are in that role. Clearly, you run a gang. I mean, we're not going to try to paint you as, you know, your motives may be good, but you are most assuredly at a maximum an anti-hero. Mm-hmm. But I always like the fact that Warrior has this open question. Who's the bad guy? What's the wrong thing? And the relationship you have with your son, not only does it provide the opportunity for amazing dialogue and monologues between the two of you and from you, because I'm totally addicted to him. I don't care what you say. Oh, you're amazing at him. So thanks. I demand you continue to stress yourself out to give this to them. But there's like Chinese mysticism that they persist in perpetuating for how you educate yourselves and educate your young and live in your community. And there's a moment in there when you're like, I need you to trust me, but trust is a two-way street. And I can't be more specific because that happened this season. Mm-hmm. But there are very few times where you get to see a father who is concerned his son is doing something wrong, but he's still perfectly content. And he's like, I'm going to let you learn that lesson. I'm gonna do what I need to do to protect us. I'm gonna continue to work. Mm-hmm. But he's watching his son make what he knows is a mistake. And he's also keeping an eye on someone in his organization. And never once do they have your character say something cliche, as cliche as keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. But yeah, it's all over your face. All over your face. So they give drama, they give dimension, they give characters, and you're not on the screen often, but when you are, you are. So but that's also another thing they don't usually give, like, especially not older Asian American men. Like, somehow or another, if you didn't fall right into being wizened looking, like, you're supposed to be erased. Like, they've completely just taken you out of the mix. So a character like Father Jim, who's smart, I mean, everybody else is playing checkers, he's playing Go, and literally, but you know, and that's also something else people have to learn. It's like they learn a different rhythm to what strategy looks like, to what's important, to what's the purpose. And then you turn around and you beat the holy hell out of someone. You're like, I'm sorry, I let you into my organization without explaining to you exactly, you know, what the rules are. I'm gonna fix that. And I was like, oh, he gonna whoop his ass.
Yeah, it's, you know, again, it's a fine line there, what you're talking about with the warrior in terms of using those sort of aphorisms, Asian Taoist aphorisms or philosophy, because actually Bruce Lee was full of them.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, be water, you know, be like water. It's so simple, but yet so real, you know, and if you actually, you know, like Shannon just released a book on a lot of his father's sayings, because they're like all so real. So the thing is, if you don't believe in how real they are and how important they are, then you can play them in the wrong way. And it can be seen. It's just a matter of presentation. You know, how are we presenting this line? And then sometimes, you know, I kind of wrestled with that several times. It's like, you don't want it to come across the wrong way. So you want it to come across with, you know, with a deep understanding of the humility of how that was transmitted to me. And respect, you know, so if you say things in a certain way, you don't have a lot of control over how they're going to edit it in a room, but you do have at least, you know, the responsibility as a conscious actor to say that this is how I want it to come across and this is what I'm going to offer them. So there are a lot of those lines in the show. And we talked about it, even with Jonathan, the writer, saying that this show is going to be full of those lines. So we have to understand how we use them. And how they can actually be part of the charm of the show and actually go beyond that and not be seen as a trope.
It feels like there's at least a different iteration in a person of the philosophies of Bruce Lee. And I mean, I hope you're very comfortable with it, but you carry a certain amount of the gravitas that kind of underlines some of it's your fault. You did it yourself. I'm sorry. I was like, this is who you are now, sir. But it works because you have sincerity, and you've given a character that this character could have been so very simple and just very bloody minded and violent, and he could have been a tyrant to his son, because that's usually how they play these characters. But because you didn't play Father Jun that way, and the tongue is built, your particular tongue, Hape, is built around you with having layers and being built on respect and loyalty. When you use those lines or you speak kind of to their ethos, saying you're too young to know what you still don't know, mm-hmm. or, you know, you're supposed to be here. We're strongest as we can be. Your brothers weren't there. I wasn't there. So you didn't have any business being there. I felt like my father walked into the room and I wanted to apologize. I wasn't there. I felt like I had failed you as a child and as a person. But it's a cultural loyalty that doesn't exist on U.S. television. I'm happy the show exists. I'm kind of sad it's on Cinemax because it's more difficult for people to get. I am glad it's going to be streaming and on demand so people can catch up. But it's an action show. It's a crime. It's got drama. But you never once picked up a weapon where it wasn't purposeful to the story and fit the character you were playing. You know, what did you feel like that process was to kind of blend those two things together for you on set?
Well, obviously, I'm tied to the script first, so I have to try to understand how I, as a character, would handle things. And like I said earlier about the aphorisms, you just kind of have to know what you're saying and really own them, you know, with a certain kind of way, gravitas that can spread as a seed, I think, as opposed to just giving people what they want. I'm going to give you the seed and you can take it and water it and do something else with it. I can't remember a specific moment when I went, you know, this is not. Well, actually, there's a moment, you know, in the first episode one, when you first see me and you come in and my character's introduced and I have this monologue that you talked about. And I have a way of playing it that I thought was going to be, you know, this is how they're going to love it. You know, so I presented that and they went, okay, rehearsal done. Let's shoot it. And then the director said, well, I think maybe I want you to be this, you know. And I went, that's the thing I'm trying to avoid, actually, you know. Trying to be that badass that you walk into in Chinatown. I don't think that's the sky, you know? The badasses don't need to be badass, right? And so, you know, you kind of wrestle a little bit with that, but, you know, everyone's looking, the clock's ticking, you know, it's my first day on the set, and I went like, can't be a problem on the set, you know? So I have to sort of like interpret what he's saying into the best way that I could present it and have that director feel satisfied. Maybe that's not exactly what he asked for, but it would be like, oh, he did something else than what I asked for, but it's, you know, it's better. And hopefully, you know, it's all right. It's all a collaboration. So you can only go by your homework and what you did with the character to stay true to the writing. And hopefully, and if you see red flags like stereotype or, you know, demeaning a woman or something like that, you can say, how am I going to deal with that? Because this is a trope and it's like, what did they mean? How can I give it how can I ask a question instead of making a statement for this moment? So we did that scene several times and I went, yeah, it's not working for me that way, you know? And I just made little tweaks and said, let's try to get this way. So I would say that sometimes when things are uncomfortable, the actor gets challenged to make it better for everyone and to try not to recede into a part where you feel like you have to do what's told, then that's not gonna, you know, translate well on camera. I don't know. Does that answer your question? It's an abstract thing unless we're looking at a very specific moment.
Well, no. I mean, it's because of the way that they've designed this entire show. It's very, it creeps up on you. Like you start with that well moment. I was like, oh, I think you know what kind of character Father Zoon is going to be. Mm-hmm. You also think, based on how he's introduced in the show, you know what the Tong Wars were and what they were about. They all start to kind of fit the known history of what you think about, oh, gangs in the quote ghetto, gangs in Chinatown, the conflict. And then it very slowly starts to turn and you start to see. And a lot of it is through you sending somewhere and telling them something before they go. Like you have a hell of a way with a throwaway line that turns out not to be throwaway. They foreshadow through your character really freaking well.
Throwaway lines are also the most important, actually.
Aren't they fun though? They're fun. Yeah. So, but what ends up happening, I'm like, okay, so we've got warring tongues in Chinatown. We've got the upper class whites and the political power structure, and they want Chinese labor because, you know, but no one really wants to talk about what we're talking about is wage slavery. And you guys do an amazing job of keeping it in context, making it historical, but challenging everything everyone thinks they know. And very frequently that's done through your character and what's happening with the gangs wars. And that's also not something that's typically done. I mean, the last time it got done for Black people on screen was The Wire. And then they made a pivot left and turned it right back into Power because they got uncomfortable with the complexity of the characters. So to see it showing up in a show like Warrior, it's relatable outside of just watching a show. It's not about watching Asian people in a show that's set based on Bruce Lee's treatment. This is a show that's just, it's got high drama. It's got nuanced characters. It's got empowered women. It's got sword fighting. It's got battles, but it also has this levels. Like, your character's backstory is he fought in the wars. He came over here. He's already seen a whole lot. He has nothing to prove to anybody. So like you described him when we started talking, you know, he's about protecting his people. And he recognizes that as much as white people want their labor and say, we don't want you to settle here, white people are also trying to demand fit in so we feel comfortable, but then denying you anything that you need to fit in.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned model minority earlier, and it's like, that is like the worst stereotype for, I feel like, for Asian Americans. A lot of Asians, you know, openly welcome that because they say, look, we're doing it right, and everyone else should do it right. It's like, no, we're not doing it right. And it's the problem with what's happening with like the anti-Asian violence now. We're honorary whites, right? Because of the model minority, Chinese or Asian Americans are always called the honorary whites. It drives a wedge between Asians in America and other people of color in America. I mean, we should always be, you know, stand in solidarity against the power, right? Power structure. And there's a great movement now because of all the social unrest and protests in America called Asians for Black Lives. And it really, you know, addresses the model minority as a myth that's created, you know, to not give other people as much as what they're asking for, because, hey, it causes anti-Asian violence and it's a problem. And it's some of the things that we're addressing in the Asian American community, that particular stereotype is dangerous. I mean, recently there was a news article about Yale discriminating against whites and Asians. It said whites and Asians, so that they can let more Blacks and Latinx people into Yale. And, you know, they should let more people, you know, in Black and Latinx people if the system was pitted against them from the beginning. But putting us with whites means, you know, again, my oldest son, who's a student in high school, said, why are they always putting us with whites? We're not white. Absolutely. You know, we are not white, and we have a very problematic relationship with white supremacy, you know, and violence in this country, you know, from the very beginning. You know, Chinatowns were also set on fire and lynched, but again, you don't hear that part of history. But yes, I mean, I try to take advantage of the opportunity that Warrior presents, and it's a great opportunity. These people love the show. I mean, everybody loves the show. The writers are so on point with what they're saying. If you look at the show, and if you've seen season two and even season one, everything that's happening in the show, power grabs, political unrest, immigrant scapegoating, that's happening right now in America. Right now, every bit of what's happening, the drama of what's happening, wedging, you know, Asians by hiring them to work on you know, the coal mining factories and not hiring Irish and forcing them to start labor unions. That's all happening right now. You know, we're blaming Mexicans now for that. But yeah, the Chinese were those Mexicans back then. So it, had this show come out even in April, maybe when COVID was first hitting, we can see how they were scapegoating immigrants and, you know, violence, the violence that's perpetuated towards, you know, people of color because of political power grab. I mean, it's all right there. And, you know, Jonathan knew all this and it was like so timely. And it's so, I mean, you know, the underdog loves the show, right? Because we just want to fight the power. We want to fight the power. And war does it with like entertainment. You know, this is entertainment, but it's true. All of it is true. So let's look at that.
No, it's high drama. It's high drama. It's a look at the interplay and dynamics in San Francisco at the turn of the century and that we don't really understand. But it's a damn good spaghetti western. And I think that's something that people forget when they want to have it. So yeah, it's got messages, it's got social commentary, but there's not a single sledgehammer in sight because they just let the show do its thing. So people are fighting. It's got an amazing cast from beginning to end. Everybody seems like they're perfect casting, which is kind of, you know, yeah.
Oh my God. I'm so in love. I'm so in love with the cast. You know, I watched season two. I'm so in love with the cast. And I'm thinking,
you got everybody up their game.
I'm like, everybody is so different from who they are in real life. Like, we hung out all, you know, a lot in Cape Town where it was shot. And we were like a family, you know, we just like, you know, we're carted everywhere and everything. And we hung out together a lot. We ate together a lot. We laughed, drank and everything a lot. And the characters are so different from the actors, from the real people. And I just love watching them. And I laugh when it's inappropriate because it's not supposed to be funny because I know the actor. And I was like, oh my God, they're so good. I love these people, you know? And so Warrior is an amazing vehicle that finally, you know, showcases some of the talents that some of these Asian, not just Asian Americans, but, you know, the white actors, the British actors, the South African white, black British actors that we had are amazing people, amazing talented people. And I think that the casting did a great job for the show.
Yeah. Well, you guys are doing some good things, but yeah, I really try to avoid spoiling because I want people to watch Warrior season two. I've watched it and I know it seems like we harp on your monologues a little, but I mean, it's your fault. But like everything's purposeful. Like I said before, it's like, you know, I know you had movement training, but when you fight and like all the choreography they give you and how they have you fight, and it blends very well with what we've come to expect for who Father Yun is and then who his son is, like, you know, the kind of Aggie aggressive, I'm going to prove my worth to my father. But then you realize there's a bigger thing that's happening this season around them. And like enemies within plus enemies without. And I'm really excited for people to see this season. I think that they couldn't have found a better head of one of the gangs for anything. And I'm biased in your favor.
Thank you.
But I think it's warranted. I think the entire show is fantastic. I've seen season two. I'm currently watching it again so I can write my review. And yeah, I think everything that you've mentioned here and how it works is why I really enjoyed this show. But I think being able to say that it is a high action-packed, martial arts-driven Western show set in period proper San Francisco will probably be what gets other people in. And then you're going to monologue them to death.
This show is so amazing. It's just like a gift from heaven, you know, to me. As I think any actor who's given a role like Father June, they're just gonna have fun, you know, because it's fun to play like the bad guy, right? But they wrote it in a way that's like, is he really the bad guy, or is he like, you know, everybody's a bad guy, yet everyone's a good guy at the same time.
Yeah, you know? I'm conflicted. I don't know. I know I'm supposed to root against you, but I often fail to. I'm not going to lie.
I think, you know, like since you've watched season one and two, you could see how the character changed by the end of season two, you know. And, and I'm, you know, like earlier I talked about responsibility as what you want to, you know, share with, you know, the audience, and, you know, beyond what's written, is like you have to do your own research and share who you are as an individual. And I think that just being a father, you know, that break I took when you first started, it's like, well, you know, you took a break. I was like, yeah, I took a break and I became a father. You know, I couldn't have done these roles if I wasn't a father. And so by the time season two comes around and I see what they did with Father June, I went, oh, that's great. Thank you. Because I could be a father. I really could be a father to this guy now who I think, you know, like, you know, my father passed away when I was young. So I kind of missed having a father, but you know, I'm trying to be the father that I never had to my sons. And like, how would I do it? Of course, I'm a little nicer than Father June in real life to my sons.
Okay, good.
But I think that I demand from them a certain kind of like their own effort to become educated, because you can't depend on high school, which right now they're doing remote learning because of COVID. They're not going to learn too much, you know, through remote learning. And so aside from what I impart to you, and our discussions and your own learning, you have to go beyond this culture to get educated. You have to go like, what educates people in, you know, in the higher education system in Africa or China, you know, or France? I mean, what are they thinking? Is and I guarantee you it's not what the U.S. is thinking.
Yeah. Okay, well, I don't think there's a better note to end on than that.
So once again, thank you for joining us on the MTR Network. I'm Ro, and we'll be back with more in the near future. Peace.